And Karen's topic is the future of religion, a report on that conference by Ken Wilber.
Thank you, John, and I am thrilled to be up here today holding forth. Let me change my distance glasses to my computer glasses so I can read this. It's almost exactly a year ago to the day since I first wandered up the hill to check out this church group. In the wake of the 2016 elections, like so many other people, I felt an urgent need to get more socially involved. I knew that UU's did a lot of social action because Unitarianism was the church of my childhood. I grew up in Livermore. My mother hauled me off to the Unitarian Fellowship there every Sunday, but I dropped it when I went off to college and out into the wider world. Half a century later, a year ago today, I came up here looking for social action, and I found this wonderful community, and I dived in, and I've been enjoying myself immensely among you ever since. So before anything else, I want to say thank you for being such a warm, wonderful community. I'm up here to report on a conference I attended a month ago in Denver over the New Year, sponsored by the philosopher Ken Wilber. The community around Wilber is much like UUCB in that it includes many high achievers in many walks of life. The conference, titled What Now, set out to pool the considerable skill set of this group and help us all up our game as we grapple with current events. Though I've been following the work of Ken Wilber for over 3 decades, I had never attended one of his conferences before this, but I couldn't not go to this one, just like I couldn't not come up here. So off I went to Denver in the dead of winter. Before I tell you about the conference, I will sketch a very brief overview of Ken Wilber's groundbreaking body of work. I'll be looking at both Wilber's work and the What Now conference from an altitude of 30,000 feet, because they both cover a lot of territory. Today, I'll focus mainly on the aspect that's of most interest to Mr. Wilber and to myself, and also probably to this community, namely spirituality and human consciousness. To give away the punchline of my talk, Wilber predicts that widespread spiritual growth will be the religion of the future. I've tried to keep my prepared talk to 45 minutes because I'm very interested in hearing your comments and questions afterwards. I will ask you to be so kind as to hold any questions until then so I can get through it all. First, let me ask, how many of you have heard of Ken Wilber? Wow. How many of you have some familiarity with his work, even a little? For those of you who are not familiar with his work, Ken Wilber has been called the greatest living philosopher. Many very big guns have given him the highest praise, including, for example, Huston Smith. They were friends. I started reading Ken Wilber's books all the way back in 1983, near the beginning of his career, and I've pretty much kept up with his work ever since. I've watched him put together his theory of everything that is, in my opinion, the most profound synthesis of all human knowledge ever. Wilber's scheme starts simply with 4 quadrants, but it gets more complicated quickly, and there are a lot of moving parts. So I'm not going to try to tackle it today in any detail. I'll just say that basically Wilber has shown, and I have to take a deep breath here, how all of human knowledge and understanding and activity fits into a larger whole. An organic, meaningful, coherent whole. All of human knowledge and activity. Everything. No kidding. For simplicity's sake, I'll label the 4 quadrants consciousness, culture, society, and science. That's just for convenience. Each field of human knowledge can be slotted into this framework, and as such, each field has even more meaning than it does all by itself because it has a meaningful organic connection with all the other fields around it and with the totality. This, not accidentally, is rather like the process whereby a cluster of single cells differentiate from each other, surrender some sovereignty as they interact, and evolve together into a much larger multi-celled organism. Each cell becomes more individual and more differentiated from other cells, in other words, more itself, at the very same time it's becoming part of a larger living whole. This is evolution in action. What each segment, or indeed quadrant, of human knowledge must surrender is its claim to be the whole picture. If I and many others are right about Ken Wilber's work, we are indeed talking about a major new evolutionary stage in human understanding. Big claim. I think it's true. To change the metaphor, Wilber has been called the Einstein of consciousness, but I see him more as the Isaac Newton of consciousness. Less than 3.5 centuries ago, Newton's laws of motion, a few simple mathematical formulae, suddenly and powerfully correlated the vast amount of observed data about the movement of the planets. This, in my humble opinion, is what Wilber's four quadrant synthesis has done with all fields of human knowledge and activity. It's beyond massive. It's a game changer. And even if and where one disagrees with him, and I do have a few quibbles about some details, his system, we can't just brush it aside. We have to engage it, even if we passionately disagree. Wilber's system is not only the most powerful synthesis of human knowledge and thought in the history of history, he's also made some essential breakthroughs on many fronts. During my talk today, I'll present just two of these, one now very quickly and one later on in more detail. Very, very quickly. Ken Wilber's four-quadrant synthesis solves the brain-mind question, which has vexed philosophers and scientists for millennia. I will skip straight to the punchline without connecting any dots on this one. It turns out that consciousness is not generated by the physical brain, nor is the brain somehow a byproduct of consciousness. Consciousness and physical matter co-arise and coexist necessarily like the north and south poles of a magnet, like yang and yin. Neither is a product of the other, neither is derived from the other, neither is reducible to the other. To stay within my time limit, that's all I'll say on this one. I know it's a teaser, I apologize, but it was too much fun to leave out. If there is any interest here at UUCB in studying Wilber's works in more detail, I would be delighted to help make it happen. But with this, I'm going to drop Wilber's four-quadrant synthesis so I can move on to the What Now conference in Denver over the new year, and why I and Wilber's integral community are optimistic about the future in spite of all the bad news. A group of very high-functioning people has gathered itself around Wilber and formed itself into a global community of thinkers, researchers, and activists. These include some leading lights from all four of Wilber's quadrants: the arts, the hard sciences, the political and social sciences, high-tech, psychotherapy, corporate law — that was a very interesting presentation — economics, business practice, and also many leading progressive thinkers in the Buddhist and Christian and even Islamic communities, and this is just the highlights. All of these fields of activity and more were represented and presented at the What Now conference. It was a thrilling group of people to hang out with for 4 days, and we had a great party on New Year's Eve, too. The premise of the conference was, how can we use the immense challenges that face us today as opportunities to co-create a world we want to live in? And how can we find the resilience and adaptability to do this? And I know that resonates with this crowd. The first order of business at the conference was to look beyond the headlines of the news cycle to see the big picture. As one of the presenters said, looking at the big picture alleviates suffering. It does. I'll say more about that. There is a whole lot of good stuff going on in the world on a whole lot of fronts. The good news far outweighs the bad news. We got to hear a lot of the good news at this conference and see the evidence. I left the conference feeling personally enriched and even more optimistic about the future than when I arrived. Part of the problem is that the good news mostly does not make it into the headlines. All we see in the news cycle is the bad news. When we do take a deep breath, step back and look at the big picture, the data shows that even with all the bad stuff happening, the quality of life all over the globe is improving for huge numbers of people, and fastest of all in some of the poorest parts of the world. There are a great many other voices of realistic optimism out there besides ours. I will just mention one in passing. Nicholas Kristof's op-ed piece in the New York Times just a few weeks ago, I think it was January 12th, and his subsequent interview with Fareed Zakaria on CNN on January 14th. The data is clear. Life is far better for far more people in percentages as well as raw numbers than ever before in all of human history. This improving trend has been going on for a long time, and in spite of the headlines, the trend is continuing even as we speak. Moreover, there's even a sort of positive spin on the upheavals of today. I'm quoting from the prospectus for the conference. These times of rampant change are generating an enormous amount of evolutionary friction, reshaping our notions of the world, our work, and our shared future. In other words, evolution is happening very fast right now. And this is where the perspective of the integral community around Wilbur meshes with my own perspective. As a historian by training, here's how I see it. Humanity has already gone through six major transitions from one era to another. Today we are in the middle of a seventh change of major era. We are leaving behind the postmodern world order that was the leading edge during all of our lifetimes, and we are moving on into whatever comes next. As my physicist father might have put it, what we are going through now is very much like a phase change in physics. Passing out of a stable state through a period of high volatility on our way to a new, different, stable state. That's why there's so much turbulence just now. We are moving out of one major historical era toward the next. This, too, is evolution in action. And we, lucky people that we have a ringside seat for the show. As a historian, I can say something else. We've seen this movie before. We know how it ends. If it's like the past six transitions, it will end in another brand new era, one that is just as new to us as the previous six were to the people of their day. We are going up yet another major step in the evolution of human society. Of course, it seems like everything is falling apart. It is. Old, outworn structures are breaking down before our eyes, and we cannot yet see the contours of the new structures that will replace them. Of course, we care deeply about the suffering of so many that we see around us while all this happens, and we care urgently about the health of the planet. We care. We really, really want to get this transition right. Even if we ourselves are untouched by the turmoil around us, we don't want to see others suffer. These difficult times call on us to be our best so that we can make things better rather than worse. I share this sense of urgency with the integral community around Ken Wilbur and with the community here. That's why we're all part of why we're all here. How to rise to this challenge practically was the whole point of the What Now conference. Excuse me. I'd sum up the consensus of the conference in these four steps. First, we look at the bigger picture, locate ourselves accurately in it, and thus see our situation more wisely and precisely. That's what the conference started by doing and what I've tried to do in my talk so far. excuse me. Second, even though the larger evolutionary picture is one of optimism, once we've seen that bigger picture, we do need to come back and acknowledge the full seriousness of the challenges that face us right now, which is what I've just done. Third, understanding that we are in a period of unusually rapid evolutionary change, we need to use the skills we have to become more evolved ourselves as individuals, lest we bring our darkness instead of our light to the work that's crying to be done. And that's what I'll be speaking about for the rest of my talk today. And then fourth, we go home and we go on with our passionately engaged work in the world, which is, of course, what we left the What Now conference to do, what we will all be doing here today, one way or another, after we go home, and it's what we do every Sunday, right? The central concern of the conference organizers was the danger that if we don't work on ourselves too, if we move out into action in the world from a place of reactivity in fear and anger and distress and blame, we risk prolonging the problems instead of moving towards solutions. This concern was, in fact, the number one motivation behind holding the What Now conference. That said, it is, of course, essential to allow ourselves to have our genuine reactions of distress at the horrors we see around us. This, too, is a key focus of the conference. We have skillful means for bringing mindfulness to our own reactivity and being present with it and embracing it. We can transmute that energy into higher octaves, right? Law of physics, matter energy can be neither created nor destroyed, but it can be transmuted into other forms. We have the tools to transmute our darkest, most painful emotions and reactions up an octave or two or three into wisdom, compassion, and skill. Our very darkest drives can become high-octane fuels that empower us as we move out into the world with wisdom and skill. But to do this takes work. It's like composting. It happens. Compost you have to work at, right? It takes work to transmute things. So likewise, these skills have to be learned and practiced if we are going to use our skills effectively. Some of these skillful means were also presented at the conference, and no surprise, some of the skillful means are already active parts of the UUCB toolkit. And the ones that I've had experience with so far here are chalice circles, nonviolent communication, or NVC, and dream workshops like the one that was just held yesterday in this room. There's probably more I haven't encountered yet, but we've got quite a toolkit here already. We have the pieces we need, right? It's a wonderful community. With all this in place, I'd like to move on to the heart of my talk today, which is the future of human consciousness. As I said earlier, the subject closest to Ken Wilber's heart and to my own is higher states of consciousness. Wilber's latest book that just came out last fall is titled The Religion of Tomorrow. It's 800 pages long. I will be merciful and boil it down to a soundbite here. The religions of the future will increasingly be comprised of growing numbers of people who will be experiencing ever higher or transrational states of consciousness. The religion of the future. Not dogmas. Not sets of ideas, experiences. Some of you may have been here 2 months ago when Dr. David Presti spoke about his work with a team of neuroscientists that the Dalai Lama had recruited to teach brain science to Tibetan monks who meditate a lot. How many of you were here for that? Oh, wow, yeah. In his answer to one of the questions put to him then, Dr. Presti said that yes, there are indeed maps to these higher states of consciousness. I forget his exact words, but he said something to the effect that these maps have been well tested and they are valid. When he said that, I remember feeling a big stir of interest in the room here, as if a lot of people really, really wanted to hear that answer. If you were one of those people, I'm here to tell you that among so much else, Ken Wilber has done the very hard work of cross-correlating these maps from all the world's major wisdom traditions. And he has shown that these maps align quite precisely with each other once you allow for differences of language and culture. Furthermore, this is important, these maps meet the validity claim for this quadrant of human knowledge. More on that in a moment, but first I want to tell you why I personally am sure that there really are higher or transrational states of consciousness. Here's a little of my personal story. Once upon a time, that's how stories begin, right? At the beginning of the 1980s, I went to live in Germany for 2.5 years. I was a graduate student in the humanities and head over heels in love with the Western Middle Ages. I'd gotten a Fulbright to go to Munich to research medieval manuscripts for my dissertation in art history. I had done some Zen meditation, but I hadn't gone very far with it. During my time in Munich, I stumbled across what became my spiritual path and began meditating in earnest. Unbeknownst to myself until then, one of my strongest attractors to the Middle Ages had been the spirituality of the monastic culture. In meditation, I found what I'd really been looking for all along, which was a direct spiritual experience. Up until that point, scholarship had been the highest form of truth I could imagine. But once I began meditating in earnest, I discovered that there are levels of truth and beauty well beyond the intellectual. So for the past 36 years, I've been meditating 2 to 3 hours a day. I've had some lapses along the way, but I've always come back to my daily meditation. It's become the foundation and the core of my life. In my outer life, I returned to Berkeley, finished my PhD in the humanities, and very gladly bailed out of academia. Different story. When I started reading Ken Wilber's books in 1983, I had already been meditating for nearly 2 years. Among much else, Wilber was saying a lot of things about so-called higher states of consciousness, a few of which I had already experienced myself. And even that back then, Wilber was putting my experiences into much larger, more coherent, and deeply meaningful contexts. I like to call the kinds of experiences we're talking about transrational because they transcend reason in much the same way reason transcends instinct. Transrational levels of experience are innate in us all. Just as instinct and emotion and reason are innate in us, even if they are not manifest in us, they are latent in everyone, and they can be experienced potentially by every single one of us. Indeed, transrational modes have been experienced and attested to by many people in all cultures and all ages, in all the millennia for which we have written records. Now, it is true that it's a huge challenge to talk about transrational experiences in words, like I'm trying to do now, precisely because words and images are the medium of the intellect, whereas these experiences transcend the intellect. But as Wilber has pointed out, people who've had transrational experiences themselves can talk about it among themselves, and they know very well what they're talking about. Importantly, here we come back to validity claims. Such people can also exert themselves to recognize what does not fit or is questionable, much like literary critics can form a consensus on valid versus invalid statements on, say, the meaning of Hamlet. Back to the matter of validity claims. All valid fields of human knowledge must have some method of validation, and this is true for explorers of consciousness just as much as it's true for any other field of knowledge. And the method that works in the other three quadrants works here too. In all four of Wilber's quadrants, consciousness, culture, society, and science, communities of practitioners have their experience, form a theory, research, test their theories, try to reproduce results, and compare their conclusions with other like-minded practitioners. The process is fallible in the hard sciences just as much as in the other three quadrants, but over time, errors and frauds tend to be weeded out. which is what the Eastern meditation traditions have done all along. For at least three millennia, communities of spiritual practitioners have slowly built up a body of consensually validated maps for transrational states of consciousness. And they've been at it an order of magnitude longer than Western scientists. And we today, lucky people that we are, for the first time ever in human history, we have access to all these maps in good translations. It's an embarrassment of riches. And the further good news is that all these maps really do add up to something coherent. Wilbur has done most of our hard work for us here, researching a vast number of these and showing how they cross-correlate. So yes, as Dr. Presti said here 2 months ago, there are valid maps of the transrational states of consciousness. Furthermore, there are known and time-tested psychotechnologies, such as the various forms of meditation, that can enable us to reproduce these states of consciousness and experience them for ourselves. And there are communities of the adequate, to use Wilbur's snarky term, that investigate and form consensus about what is valid and what is not among these maps. So far, so good, but... there's another aspect we need to consider before we get to all happy about this. Pathologies are possible at all levels of cognitive development. It turns out that the transrational states and stages are not an exception to this. Thanks largely to Ken Wilbur, but also to many others, we now also have at least the beginning of some descriptions of the pathologies possible in each of these transrational states. On this front, too, Wilbur has done groundbreaking as well as synthesizing work. Stick a pin in this, as Rachel Maddow likes to say. We will come back to it. Earlier in this talk, I said I'd be going into more detail on one philosophical issue. That's what I'm going to do now. The issue is the relation between the transcendent and the manifest, or form versus emptiness. This issue has come up at least twice in the personal theology talks I've attended here during the past year. It's a biggie, and it seems awfully abstract, but it turns out to have some practical consequences, which I will get to. Last spring, Dr. Pappas gave a presentation here on heaven versus nirvana. Were any of you here for that? See, yeah, a few hands. During the questions, I remember Lonnie asked Dr. Pappas something to, if I understood the question, something to the effect of, can you have both at the same time? Can you experience both manifestation and the transcendent? And Dr. Pappas answered, no, it's got to be one or the other. I may have understood the question and the answer, but as I recall, I recall disagreeing and wanting to hear a different answer. And of course, I piped up and said so. But in any case, on this issue too, Wilbur has gathered massive amounts of evidence across many traditions that showing that the transcendent and manifest also turn out to co-arise and coexist, like the north and south pole of a magnet. To quote one of the Buddhist sutras, form is emptiness. Emptiness is form. Form is not other than emptiness. Emptiness is not other than form. Wilbur has a whole lot to say about this in his latest book. Once again, he has not only synthesized the evidence from all the world's wisdom traditions, he's added further essential and groundbreaking insights. Please bear with me as I stay abstract for just a few more paragraphs. We will get practical soon. Let's consider the transcendent. Of course, I say this ironically, because by definition, we cannot grasp the transcendent with our intellects. But hey, why let that stop us from trying, right? The transcendent, the unmanifest, Godhead, the cloud of the unknowing, also called the void in Buddhist terminology. This is eternal, never changing, always and everywhere fully present. In some schools of thought, it is cognized as pure consciousness. It is always fully present, even to our awareness, potentially, if not actually. Any human, at any level of development, no matter how primitive they may be, can experience the transcendent, at least in brief, fleeting glimpses. Now, how she understands such an experience and explains it to herself and others will depend upon her level of cognitive sophistication within the realm of the manifest, and that turns out to be very important too, but that's a whole other discussion, okay? Where the transcendent is eternal and unchanging, the manifest, on the other hand, is transient. It changes over time. By the manifest, I mean the universe of matter-energy that we interact with and that we perceive. And this would include any subtler realms of being, such as the etheric or astral, if you happen to believe in such. Okay, the manifest. Wilbur has pointed out that the West has made some essential contributions to our understanding here, specifically. The manifest, the universe of matter energy that we perceive, does more than just change over time. It evolves. Evolution. This is an immense insight. Even in our Western world, sizable portions of our population have not been able to really get their minds around it. In fact, a deep grasp of evolution tends to undermine the whole pre-modern mindset. And that's about a third of our population in the U.S., which is still essentially pre-modern in outlook. That's a whole other subject, okay? Put that one aside. Pre-modern, traditional cultures understood that the manifest realms change with time, but they all assumed that the ages of existence go around repeating the same cycles endlessly, right? Pre-modern mindset. On this front, evolution, the current scientific consensus contradicts the cyclical mythologies of all pre-modern worldviews. In our postmodern version of it, our manifested universe has been bringing forth structures of ever greater complexity for something like 13.8 billion years, ever since the Big Bang, and that's in spite of the second law of thermodynamics for you physicists. Furthermore, these structures of increasing complexity support increasingly complex types of embodied consciousness. This, too, is a critical point. Consciousness in its manifested aspect also evolves over time into more and more complex states of cognitive capacity, and it does this alongside the evolution of complex forms. So, okay. On the side of manifestation or form, matter and consciousness co-evolve. And now let's move from the abstract toward the practical. Let's consider the evolution of organic life into animals, then mammals, then primates, then Homo sapiens, us. Side by side with the evolution of our human bodies, our human psyche has, of course, also evolved with us into its present state of cognitive capacities. Furthermore, and this is critical, our very understanding of the human psyche has also evolved. Today we know much more about the human psyche than we did even 150 years ago. The great Eastern meditation traditions took shape during the pre-modern era. While today's psychological sciences, such as they are the product of modernity and postmodernity. The great Eastern schools of meditation are still far ahead of the West in some of their explorations of the higher ranges of human consciousness, but they did not go into some of the more mundane areas of the psyche that Western psychology has. Which brings me to a specific issue that's very close to my own heart for a reason I'll tell you shortly. Today we understand much more about the unconscious parts of our psyche, our individual personalities, than we ever did in any previous era on Earth. We have come to understand how powerfully the unconscious aspects of our personalities can shape our thinking and behavior. One of these aspects is the so-called shadow. And just for today, I'm using the term shadow very specifically to mean contents of our consciousness that ought to be in our waking awareness but are not because we actively repress them. We actively push them out. Okay, a very specific term for today. In other words, we all play shell games with our own awareness. Some of us much more than others, but we all do it to some extent. Today there exist some powerful psychotherapeutic techniques for getting into a healthier relationship with the unconscious parts of our psyches, including this so-called shadow. Doing this kind of work, shadow work, frees us to be guided by the better angels of our natures instead of being driven by our repressed and unappeased personal demons. Ooh. Here's the point I'm driving toward. Wilbur has analyzed how even human beings who have reached very high spiritual states and can genuinely be considered enlightened can still have unresolved shadow issues if these have not been separately addressed. Okay? Traditional forms of meditation by themselves will not reach or transform shadow materials. Wilbur has shown this in a way I find convincing. No traditional meditation technique, no matter how tried and true, can in itself locate or handle actively suppressed material in the shadow portion of the human psyche because this stuff is actively evading awareness. And this flatly contradicts what traditional meditation teachers have always said and most are still saying today. Here, I think, is one of the Achilles heels of the great Eastern meditative traditions, as wonderful as they are, and as necessary as they are. As true and powerful and essential as these techniques can be for developing higher, even to transcendent states of consciousness, they never developed a means to shine the light of awareness into actively suppressed contents of consciousness. How could they? The existence of actively suppressed contents has only been discovered in the course of the last 150 years. Thanks to this insight of Wilbur's, we can understand how it is possible to be a genuinely spiritually enlightened person and, nevertheless, still at times be driven by unconscious dark agendas. And this explains the horrors that have happened, not just in weird cults, but also occasionally even in the most reputable spiritual communities. Out of Wilbur's immense body of work, I've chosen this one aspect to look at in some depth today because it's one that's most meaningful to me. 3 years ago, I left the spiritual community that had been the center of my life for more than 3 decades, and I did so precisely over this issue. If I had not had Ken Wilbur's work to help me understand what was happening before my eyes, I would have been devastated. As it is, I've been able to go through this passage with at least a little equanimity, And let me say again how much it means to me to have found a spiritual home in this community. I've kept my meditation practice of decades, and my own inner spiritual connection is not going to go away, but life is awfully lonely without a like-minded community. So from my heart, thank you all for being here. Well, things like this happen from time to time because such is human nature, right? The good news is that we in the West have developed some highly effective psychotechnologies for addressing these kinds of shadow issues. And this field, among so many others, is advancing very rapidly. Ken Wilbur likes to joke that one of his main jobs is to marry Freud and the Buddha. I say amen to that, although I'd like to substitute Jung for Freud, just personal preference. Now, back to the future. And why I and the integral community are optimistic about it. As a historian by training, my own optimism is based on my reading of big history. The universe has that 13.8 billion year track record of evolving structures of greater complexity, and along with it, more complex forms of consciousness. 13.8 billion years! That's a very large data spread. I say we can draw some robust conclusions. Evolution happens. It happens in all four of Wilbur's quadrants: the physical universe with its biological life, the human psyche, and in human societies and in cultures. All four quadrants co-evolve. Right now, we happen to be going through one of these occasional periods of accelerated change. Yes, it's intense. We are moving away from an old, outworn world order into one that has yet to emerge. The big picture is the good news. This has happened many times before in the universe and on this planet, and even six times already in the history of human societies. It's really scary out there right now, and awful things really are happening awfully fast, and too many people are caught in them. But as a historian, when I look at comparable periods in our past, I can only say that we're getting off very lightly, at least so far. My personal historian's view of the big picture slots very neatly into Wilbur's larger synthesis. And over the decades, his work has in turn hugely shaped my own detailed cognitive map of how everything hangs together. Of course, we don't know if our own period of volatility is going to get worse before it gets better. And how long will it take before things start getting better? We don't know. And that by itself is very scary. I'm stressing the positive today because, first, there really is a lot to be positive about. But also because seeing the big picture can indeed help us calm down and focus and effectively use the skills we have as we roll up our sleeves and get back to work. And maybe, just maybe, we can be skillful enough to alleviate some of the suffering this time through. At this point, I'd like to plug my own work. I love it that the organ music just came on here. Wow. Another synchronicity. I'm writing a novel set 11,000 years ago, early in the agricultural revolution. My main character is a Stone Age priestess who spent her lifetime helping her people make the big transition of their day from hunter-gathering to early farming, and died quite dramatically as a human sacrifice. The story is set in that era, but it's really about us and the passage we're going through today. And the whole point will be that it really is okay to move forward into the era that's upon us already. I'm hoping to start a blog soon featuring my rather fierce heroine. She's very opinionated and almost entirely uninhibited. 11,000 years ago, they had not yet invented inhibitions. She's itching to make snarky comments on current events from her Stone Age point of view. We're aiming to go live with the blog, I hope, in April. If you're interested in hearing about it when it happens, my business cards are in the back in that little black and yellow stand, and I'll be passing around a clipboard you can sign up for. Also, please feel free to take a card or sign the sheet if you just want to get in touch and chew further on anything I've talked about today. I'll take just a few more minutes to wrap up. As consciousness and matter energy continue to co-arise, or at least co-evolve, the integral community around Ken Wilbur predicts that ever greater numbers of people will reach higher states of consciousness ever more rapidly. This, in fact, will be the religion of the future, which is experiences, not dogmas or ideas, but experiences. This accelerating growth in consciousness will parallel the accelerating advances in science and technology. These will also be paralleled by advances in Wilbur's other two quadrants, which are culture and society. All four of Wilbur's quadrants will continue to co-arise and co-evolve, just as they've been doing for 13.8 billion years. Now, in case some of the transrational stuff I've talked about today sounds a bit woo-woo to you, here's one more little piece of good news, not so little. Advances in brain science are helping us verify those meditation techniques that are genuine and effective. These advances, along with our increasing toolkit of psychotechnologies, will also help us identify pathologies and expose frauds. We will be doing this with increasing power and precision. When it comes to claims about states of consciousness, we will increasingly be able to distinguish the information from the noise. Okay. And I swear to God, I wrote this last paragraph 3 weeks ago, and I only just heard a few days ago from Charlie that the last two personal theology talks here in this room were about this very subject. And that's another delightful synchronicity. I regret I wasn't able to be here for those talks. I'm glad they happened. And in closing, I want to say that it matters that we pursue our own individual growth in Wilbur's first quadrant, human consciousness. It matters hugely. As our sciences and technologies advance at an ever-increasing pace, we need to grow our consciousness and wisdom at the same pace, right? It's pretty fast. We can do it. Because growth in consciousness brings with it growth in wisdom. The so-called higher states of consciousness, when they are working as advertised, are well known to bring with them certain qualities such as greater insight and compassion, and more evolved sets of ethics. Along with these come greater capacity to deal with complexity and conflict. These, I don't need to rub this in this group, these are precisely the personal skills we will be needing as we engage with the challenges that face us. I'd like to give the last word to the late Dr. Jeremy Taylor. As quoted in yesterday's Dream Workshop in this very room, calling on all of us to make peace with ourselves so that we are capable of authentic engagement with the issues of peace and justice in the larger world. So, covered a lot of ground very fast, and now I would love to hear your comments and questions.
I think the most rapidly growing philosophical and religious movement today among the young is science fiction.
Ha.
Where does that fit into your picture?
First of all, I forgot to do this. I'd like to pass around the clipboard in case anybody is interested in chewing on this any further or hearing about my blog. I have learned in recent years to call it speculative fiction because it's been increasingly lumped in with fantasy and even horror. And it's getting harder to tell the difference from them between fantasy and fiction. I don't even think of it as fiction. I think of it as all speculative, exploring the outer reaches. I can't tell where reality and fantasy... I mean, really, everything we perceive is our own construct inside our own head. So I really don't even draw the distinction. Does that answer your question?
Not really, but good enough for now.
Okay. Come back at me later when you've got the next version of your question.
Hi, Karen.
Hi.
You mentioned that there were six changes that have happened. Can you
sure.
just list those for
sure.
us?
Number one, becoming Homo sapiens. Try to keep this to sound bites instead of a TED talk. A few things that came with Homo sapiens were far greater adaptability. Every other, well, Neanderthals, previous hominids had one toolkit. You know, one way they nap stones to make stone tools. Once you get Homo sapiens, you have a rapidly evolving toolkit, much more adaptable than previous species. Something new happened with Homo sapiens, so that was the first one. From Homo sapiens to the first evidence of culture, cave paintings, bone flutes, cave art, burials. So we have the first evidence of culture, what we can call culture, art, as evidence of some sense of spirituality, some sense of an afterlife, about 70,000 years ago. So first Homo sapiens, maybe about 2 million years ago, that's argued, say 2 million. About 50,000 to 70,000 years ago, culture. about 10 to 12,000 years ago, the agricultural revolution. And with each of these steps up comes a new technology, a new form of society, a new religion, a whole new way of organizing your life, a whole different way of understanding the world. Okay. From hunter-gathering, from agriculture to for which the religion was shamanism. Let's see. Hunter-gatherers were shamans. The agriculturalists began the mythologies, the pantheons of many gods and goddesses. So that's the new religion at that level. Moving to the axial age, you get the great axial religions, the great monotheisms, right? Judaism, Christianity, Confucianism, and so on, Buddhism. With that comes the Bronze Age and Iron Age writing, written language, whole new communication technologies, whole new psychologies, whole new family structures and societies, polities. From there to the modern era, where are we, five? The scientific revolution, capitalism, the modern world, newspapers. From there to postmodernism, and that only happened like 75 years ago, emerging with the 60s, postmodernism emerged as a whole new world order. With the internet, the computers and the internet came along in there, a whole new way of understanding the world. That was six. Every one of those transitions had a period of adjustment. The ones that we have historical evidence for, written evidence, are only the last three. And there was a dark age in between those. There were dark ages, periods of great upheaval. The way I read history, the period of transition into from modern to postmodern was World War I, the Depression, World War II, and out of that emerged the New World Order, you know, Bretton Woods, the whole, you know, the United States kind of marshaling the world, the Cold War. So those are the six great eras as I see them. Does that give me, okay.
So when would you say the period of accelerated evolution that we're in right now started?
It depends on which strand you're following. Are you following the social studies? Are you following technologies? I mean, this is not one thing. It's a cable woven of many strands. So you can place them in the beginning in different decades. It's been brewing, for decades. The thing that gets me hyperventilating is that each of these major changes, and you don't have to start with human society, you can go all the way back to the Big Bang, where a major new order of complexity happens, you need a new science to study it. You can track these and chart them, and each next step up happens an order of magnitude faster than the one before it. This is a logarithmic chart. And we here are the first group of people on the planet who have experienced two of these in our lifetimes. We experienced the 60s when a whole new world order emerged. And now we're starting to see, now we're starting to go through the passage into the next. This has never before happened on the face of the earth that in one human lifetime we've seen two of these transitions. And if this order, this logarithmic scale goes on, that means it's just going to keep getting faster. That's where I start hyperventilating. But I console myself that saying, in my rudimentary understanding of math, when you are standing on a parabolic curve, a logarithmic curve, the area behind you, if you look backwards, all looks flat. Everything ahead of you looks vertical. It doesn't matter where you're standing on it. So, I mean, this is business as usual, too. And the millennials who are coming up, I have to say, the few of them I've interacted with all seem like, oh, yeah, bring it on. You know, they've got their devices. They're comfortable. They know they're going to be using them off their brainwaves pretty soon. Yeah, bring it on. So, I mean, I think they're going to be wired differently. I mean, neurologically wired differently. They're already wired differently than we are because they've had these things from infancy. And so maybe the pace of change really can keep on accelerating. I don't know if that really answered your question.
Well, I was sort of wondering about, you know, the age of Aquarius and the returning and there's been things like that talked about for decades already.
Yes.
So why you're saying right now is different or
I think we're starting in consciousness. There's a lot of out there I agree with. We're starting a new octave, as it were. We've got only this is a septave. We've gone up six levels, and now we're starting a new tier. It's the top rung of the old octave, but it's the first note of the next, and that has to do with the higher consciousness. And I do agree with those who say this is going to come in awfully fast. Is that
okay?
Yeah.
The shadow self, what is it? It's something that you were saying that meditation doesn't deal with, the shadow self. Is it our human weakness, this shadow self? Because that's how I would define it within myself. Mm-hmm. You know, I do the things I don't want to do, and the things I want to do, I don't do, which everybody is guilty of.
Uh-huh.
That's what I believe.
Okay.
Is that the shadow self? Because it seems kind of fuzzy.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm using the term shadow here in a very precise and limited way. Mm-hmm. What you were talking about, I think, is in human nature.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's the way we are. And I don't think of it in terms of being a weakness or a fault. It's just what we have to deal with. Mm-hmm. And we learn by doing. I mean, here we are. I mean, oh, wow, that didn't work. Let me try it differently. I think some of what I think you were talking about, I would just call, you know, habits that I would like to change because they're not good for me or the people around me. And so we try to work at it. The shadow, as I've defined it here, very precisely means things that we actively are resisting seeing in ourselves. And that's a very small subset of our psyche. And it's a very wiggly guy. And we have to use special techniques to go find it. Answer your question?
Yeah, but it would not be like Eastern meditation or anything like that.
Eastern meditation will take care of all the other stuff you're talking about.
But not that.
It will not take care of that. And that, the Buddhist community in this country for 30, 40 years, there have been people who've been meditating very hard, very diligently. And this has been the result. And that's why among the Buddhist community, a lot of the really advanced Roshis are also psychotherapists. Mm-hmm. They've learned that to be effective, you need both.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm a part of the millennial generation, which is scary for a lot of people, I think. But I'm a mother. I have three small children, and we are entering, or I guess, as in my childhood, we kind of entered this age of technology.
Right.
Everyone's got a device. I can look up any answer, and it's right there. And so that's really tricky. But I don't want to raise my children that way. And so we're kind of an outsider. And I'm just curious if there's a subgroup of people who says, you know, I don't really like the direction this is going. We're not kind of following that constant.
Mm-hmm.
Do we then, I don't know if it's necessarily possible, but we're not going to break the evolution of that. But is there any benefit? I mean, I guess that's a broad question for one person to answer, but how do you express that to the world that just because everyone right now, the thing is STEM, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, and that's lovely. It's all very important stuff. But eventually we're going to get to a point where we don't know how to grow a crop or to hunt and gather and do those things. So is our evolution ever going to cause more damage than help?
Everybody at every stage has always worried about this. Yes, I am confident that we will continue to feed ourselves one way or another. That's numero uno, right? Well, after breathing. As far as managing the new technology, we're going to have to learn new sets of habits. And we're finding up, and every step up in a new technology, a new society, has immediately come face to face with new sets of problems. I mean, we are going to need to learn to ration our exposure to these, and this is already getting in our faces. It's not good for us to be on the device all the time, what this is doing to our attention span. I mean, this is a concern for me, too. We learn to ration our exposure to it. We learn how much is too much and pull back from there. I'm having fun in my novel. They've invented beer very recently. There's enough grain to make beer, and that's part of why you do the hard slog of being a farmer. But my poor hero and priestess is looking at what happens when everybody gets drunk, and then they trash the town and say, human society cannot possibly withstand the impact of beer. This is just, we just don't have it in us to be in control of this. And then slowly, painfully, they learn how to just, you know, okay, you don't take that second beer until after sunset, and you take carefully craft a set of taboos and so on. We've always learned this the hard way, and I am confident that we will learn by doing this time too. Does that get to what you asked about? Okay.
Hi. Many of the things that come up, I strongly disagree with.
All right.
Beer was not invented so people could get drunk. Beer was invented as a nutritional aid.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That was the purpose of beer, as was wine.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me that your whole set of thoughts have some underlying assumptions here, which you haven't talked about. Sort of a cornucopian approach to what the future is going to look like.
Yeah.
The reason we're having a great deal of, well, you might say evolution or talking about these issues now is because of cheap energy and rapid exploitation of the Earth itself. That's mm-hmm. the physical aspect of things. Science has been used in the direction of, you know, creating, 6.5 billion people and, you know, affluence for many people. So I'm wondering what your sort of cornucopian approach to the future will get to when we run out of a lot of these resources mm-hmm. and we drop down to a much lower energy society, you know. We're not looking at that yet. Anyway.
Okay. No, I didn't address that side of things at all because I was limiting myself to 45 minutes so I could hear comments like, and afterwards, by the way, if you want to come and tell me what some of the unexamined assumptions were, I'd really like to hear it. About this, yes, actually, I think the limitations of energy and water resources will resolve themselves in about 20 years. I'm expecting, if not solar technology, then one of the others in the offshoots. I think the challenge facing us from the middle of the century on is going to be virtually limitless, virtually free, very clean energy. That's what I see coming technologically. As far as resources go, we are getting much smarter about managing what we have and doing more with less. And the thing about resources, like physical resources, they don't leave the surface of the planet. You know, once we've mined something and made some device out of it, that doesn't stop existing because it's no longer in the earth. What with nanotechnology and such, we are rapidly getting really good at basically refining and reusing what we've already got. We've already dug it up out of the earth. There is a limited source of things that we burn up, such as the fossil fuels, but we are nowhere near peak. Fossil fuel, there's still a lot more underground. We just have time for platitudes here. You know, we could go into details. If you'd like to chew on other stuff further, I'd love to another time. The Stone Age did not end because we ran out of stones. The Stone Age ended because metal came along, right? You know, we keep finding newer and newer and newer and newer ways to do more and more with less. Anyway, I'd love to chew on this further with you if any time it amuses you.
I have a couple of related questions. What, in your mind or in your opinion or Ken's opinion, is the difference between the mind and consciousness? And a related question is, I think you said earlier in your talk that the brain and the mind are neither causes the other. Maybe I misunderstood you, but it seems, I mean, the mind comes from the brain and consciousness comes from the brain, I believe. If you disagree, where does consciousness come from?
That's an unexamined assumption. Let's examine it. maybe all of matter is a byproduct of consciousness. Maybe it goes the other way around. I'm going to go a step further than Ken Wilber and quantify this. Okay, right. Energy equals mass times the speed of light raised to the power of 2, okay? Here's the North Pole, South Pole. Consciousness equals matter times the speed of the light raised to the power of 9. Let's test this theory. How are we going to test it? That's my working theory. I see consciousness, matter, vast field of manifestation between these two poles. They co-arise like the North and South Pole. I will add one more thing. If I took a radio and went to some tribe that had never before been contacted by any modern person, there probably doesn't exist such a thing, and yet I still had a radio reception, I turned on the radio. These people would assume that that little box is generating the contents that they're hearing. My model, we don't have time to go into any great detail, but just my personal theology, my working model is that the physical brain is like a radio set. It's like a transceiver. It receives very subtle signals and transmutes them into forms that we can cognize. I don't see the physical brain as generating the contents of our awareness. And that's a very big subject we don't have time for here. But just thank you for pointing that out, because that is an assumption that is an unconscious assumption on the part of many people in modern and postmodern culture that, well, of course, consciousness is a byproduct of brain activity. What else could be? Well, there are other options out there, and you can agree or disagree, but it's fun to chew on it anyway. Thank you.
Karen Islani, it's absolutely brilliant. I just thank you so much. I cannot even believe I got you as a member here. So I'm very happy, and we'll be following up with starting some just discussion groups on adult exploration where we
sure.
sit and we can just drill down on stuff like David's talking about and Ray, and that would be just wonderful. So, but in terms of evolution, where my question is that the human brain, the evolutionary brain, you know, old brain, new brain, seems to have maintained its fight, flight, all of its aggression. I mean, we're getting better, but that seems, you know, that seems to not be moving in as fast a pace as some of these other stages that you're, talking about that we're moving in. And I understand that's why I'm at this church. Is that, you know, we walk our talk, we understand, we try to get at mm-hmm. that consciousness. But what's the resistance with the brain in terms of its evolution? Mm-hmm. You know, why are we still talking about this now?
When we move from third grade to fourth grade, we do not throw in the trash everything we learned in third grade, right? When we move from fourth grade to fifth grade, we do not erase everything we learned in the previous grades. I'm going to use the metaphor of a ladder. We do not reject the step of the ladder we've moved up from. It is essential to the integrity of the ladder. Our reptilian hindbrain is absolutely essential to keep us alive. We add something new on top. So to transcend to a higher level does not mean negating what happened before. It means adding something more to it as a greater whole. And ideally, all of them work together in harmony. We need our reptilian hindbrain. We need our mammalian limbic system. We need that. It's not an enemy. Sometimes the more primitive reactions hijack the higher functions when we didn't want them to. Well, we're here to learn by doing, right? Okay, so, wow, look what happened. How do we do it maybe better the next time? And I will take this a little further now, and this could be a whole subject for a seminar. But one of the reactions we tend to have culturally as we move up from an earlier level of culture to a later one on the development, higher on the ladder, part of how we do that is by rejecting the old one and demonizing it. You know, like, what is the devil? The devil is the god Pan. Pan was a great god in the ancient Mediterranean world. Well, the devil, you know, the goat from the waist down, the cloven hoofs, the horns, the beard. We, culturally, it seems to be how we push off. When we're ready to move up to a higher level, we do that by pushing off the lower one, and then we demonize it because we're still attracted to it, and that's kind of how we rise above it. We demonize things that we are moving away from. And we tend to develop like an allergy to the level we're moving away from, and that's a cultural thing, not a physiological thing. But I'm using it, this is an important point on all fronts, that we don't reject past stages. We don't reject kindergarten because we're now in fifth grade. We don't reject the pre-modern religions because they were in our past. They are, every rung of the ladder is essential to the integrity of the ladder. And our job is, like with our own nervous systems, our endocrine systems, our amygdalas that are saying, when we need to be calm, right? Our challenge is to support the health of the entire ladder at every level. Let every level be healthy at its level. Okay, does that?
Okay. Okay, probably one or two more quick questions.
Okay.
How do you see the progress of the whole field of compassion versus cruelty?
As evolution continues in consciousness as well as matter, compassion is one of the things we evolve toward. And I believe evolution on this front too will continue accelerating. I look, as a historian, I look at the world today and I see we are so much farther along than we ever have been before. You don't have to go very far in the past to see how much worse things were, even in the recent past. I mean, 100 years ago, bull baiting and cockfighting was legal. It wasn't very nice, but it was legal. You go back 2,000 years ago to the time of Christ, and compassion was not considered a virtue by the ancient Romans. Virility, if you're a virile man, that's virtue. Compassion, that's for weaklings, that's for wimps. I mean, just the evolution of compassion as a value is pretty recent in human history. And, you know, as a historian, I'm very encouraged. I think the growth of compassion as an expected baseline for our actions, that's very new. And I think that will go on accelerating.
I love what you're saying. It's great.
Thank you.
If you want to learn more about the stages you're talking about, where would you go for a starter?
Stages, can you be a little more specific?
Yeah, so the six stages and the seventh stage we're going in through.
Okay, the historical stage, gosh. Take a card and email me. I'd have to think about that one.
Okay, thanks.
Because I've kind of put that together for myself as far as I know.
Actually,
I mean, this is not just a primer. This is like a whole college course from Big History. Big History by David Christian. If any of you are familiar with the teaching company, they put out these wonderful college courses for everybody. Big History goes precisely through this, and you can just get it and read the book, or you can listen to all 24 or 36 of the half-hour segments. It's brilliant. Bill Gates has created a foundation specifically dedicated to getting that in every high school in the country. He thinks it's that important, and I agree with him. They did come up with a coffee table book, Big History, David Christian. Okay, it's not a primer. It's a really lovely coffee table book with lots of groovy illustrations. So that would be my first reflex, but if you want to take a card, and I'll see if I can come up with anything else.
Okay, I think maybe we've run out of time. And so thank you very much, Karen.